The Public Safety Committee will come to order. Members, we have a quorum. Where are the minutes? Could I have a motion to approve the minutes of March 12th? Representative Lesh moves that. Are there any discussion on the minutes? All those in favor signify by saying aye. Aye. Opposed?
No.
That motion prevails. Okay, so we have four bills on the agenda today, and so House File, 1126, Representative Winkler is first.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. House File 1126.
Is that wait 1 second, Representative Winkler? So, Representative Winkler, this could have a we've requested a fiscal note on it. So I'm just wondering, So the motion will be that House File 1126 will be laid over for possible inclusion in the Public Safety Omnibus Finance Bill.
Mr. Chair, that was my understanding.
Okay, very good.
And I'm sure it will be included, Mr. Chair, because it's really good.
Please go ahead.
Members, Mr. Chair, House File 1126 really does two things. It defines position of authority as it applies to a large group of people who work with teens by extending it to a time frame of 24 months beyond the end of the position of authority relationship. And it adds to the list of professionals who cannot initiate any kind of sexual relationship with teens because of their relationship to them through the schools, teachers, coaches, staff, or volunteers. So essentially, members, this says that somebody who works at a school may not engage in sexual contact with a teen for a period of 24 months after they've had that position of authority with them, and it extends that list of people who may not do this to basically anyone who works in the school building. And I have a couple of testifiers here who can lay out some more of the details for you.
Very good. Who wants to go first?
I will. My name is Stacy St. George. I'm an assistant Isani County attorney, and I'm also the chair of the Access to Justice Committee with Minnesota Coalition Against Sexual Assault. I'll be speaking briefly, and then Ms. Dunn will also be speaking after myself. I'm here to speak on behalf of the position of authority change. Clearly, this is a law about protecting children. We live in a state that already has a position of authority piece to our law. This is to help cover the loophole. We ask our children to recognize authority at a very young age. We tell them to listen to their teachers, to don't backtalk, to not question things. We ask them to have blind faith in that authority, and that's necessary. Because of this blind faith, children who follow this authority are often subject to perpetrators. This is a perfect place for a perpetrator to exist. One does not need to look very far to hear numerous cases in the media regarding police officers, teachers, coaches, mentors, Boy Scout leaders, all perpetrating on our youth. We all agree that these acts are not only abhorrent, but they're criminal. The question today is not whether or not a school official who's acting in that authority at the time of the sexual act should or should not have sex with children. Clearly, the answer to that is it's criminal and they shouldn't. The question today is, really, how far after being in that actual position, being the teacher, should we reach out? Imagine, if you will, a 16-year-old child. She has a horrible home life. There's no dad in the picture. Mother is strung out on drugs. But despite all of this, and we can all identify these children in our communities, despite this, she goes to school, and she goes to school every day, and she does a fairly good job, but she's struggling, and she's struggling in math. So the school, knowing that she needs some help, gets a math teacher and a math tutor. He's a contractor. He's 40 years old. She's 16 years old. During the time in which he's assisting her, he makes her feel confident. He makes her feel good. He makes her feel beautiful. He does nothing inappropriate against the law when he puts his hand on the small of her back as he guides her in and out of the room, as he gives hugs that linger a little bit longer. What I'm describing to you, ladies and gentlemen, is what's called grooming. What we find in these cases, as a prosecutor for almost 9 years now, and I prosecute solely violent crimes, what I'm finding is these perpetrators are so intelligent and so good at their job that what they do is they groom that child while they are in the position of authority and then wait until after the school year is over. In this particular case, this tutor no longer is her tutor. The contract is over, but he starts to drive her home. Because what perpetrators do is they groom the community, they groom the parents, they groom the children. And so it is until after the actual time in which he's a tutor that he begins the sex acts. And many people are surprised to learn that because she's 16 years old, that's no longer a crime the way our law is written today. Because of the bill introduced, it would be a crime. And I ask that you support that law. Thank you.
Thank you for your testimony. Are there any questions of the Assistant County Attorney?
Mr. Chair.
Representative Lesh.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Ms. St. George, which county do you prosecute in?
Isandy.
So Isandy County, which, Mr. Chair, is Lesh. Cambridge in...
Ms. St. George.
Okay, Mr. Chair, thank you. So I lived in Cambridge a little bit. I was less than 1 year old, but I'm not really a native, but maybe for like 6 months. But my question is for you, Ms. St. George. Say this happened in Cambridge, a smaller town. I'm not sure what the population is, but I'm guessing it's south of 20,000. And the concern is not with the 40-year-old creeper as it is with the 18-year-old kid. Who manages the Dairy Queen in Cambridge. And a 16-year-old girl gets a job there cooking onion rings for a period in the spring. It doesn't work out, but she leaves after a week. Less than 2 years later, maybe a year and a half, they start dating at the high school. Now, at the time, she never worked for him as a supervisor, but he was technically a supervisor at the Dairy Queen at the time. They become boyfriend-girlfriend. They have sex. Boom. He's a sex offender. He has to register as a sex offender for the rest of his life. How do you square that, and is that a just result?
Ms. St. George.
Thank you. If I understand your scenario, he's 18 at the time that he's her supervisor, and then is in school past his 18th birthday. I apologize for not understanding your scenario.
Representative Lesh, you want to restate your facts?
Mr. Chair and Ms. St. George, no, and maybe you can tell me if this only matters of whether he's in school. I'm talking about whether he's a manager at the Dairy Queen at the time. And she works there. Because the line I'm concerned about is line 1.12, no matter how brief. So she works there for a brief period of time. There's not adequate amount of time to groom anyone. Presumably, if he's an 18-year-old kid and she's 16, it's one of those things where we wouldn't presume that there's a grooming activity going on. Maybe there is. Who knows? But normally, this bill is stated to close a loophole. Is this the loophole we're really trying to close here? And would it have an unjust result on the 18-year-old and the 16-year-old?
Ms. St. George.
Thank you, sir. And I understand your question, and I think it's a legitimate one. I think, and I apologize for my question back to you. It was more so I wanted to make sure we were talking at which line we were talking about, because when we're talking about someone being a school teacher, that's a different paren than the scenario that you're giving. So I apologize if I didn't understand your original question. I do think that is a concern. One of the conversations we had in our committee is ensuring that we are using this law to show when there is a grooming process. Case law has helped develop that idea that we need to be able to tie the grooming, tie the relationship. For example, when we added in paren P, we talked about, because the actor's employment volunteer contractual status, the actor has access to the complainant. I think that can be the same issue that you are addressing if we add that language.
Ms. St. George, so the, on line 614.614, is that, you know, I never know exactly how to slice and dice the years here, but Representative Lesch, maybe, is that that would be that the actor is 4 years older than the than the victim, if I understand.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Yes, and yes, I sometimes have trouble slicing and dicing this as well. So the 4 years may be where I got into trouble on that, but say the age is 20 and 16. Now, and the reason I ask this, members, is everyone on this committee probably has a slightly, it's probably not that far apart, but a slightly different age at which something should be construed in the common vernacular of statutory rape. Someone would say 20 and 16. They'd be like, well, you know, I grew up in a small town. Sometimes that kind of things happen. And then someone would say 20 and 16. And another person on this committee would say, absolutely not. Are you kidding me? That's disgusting. That's inappropriate. So we're forced in this committee to have to come to a conclusion about where this is. And the breakdown over the historical common decision by the legislature is this list here, and as well as in the list for second degree, which you're familiar with because you prosecute. My concern is by expanding that list with the language that's added, extending it out to 2 years, especially when the time period is no matter how brief, I think that's a larger opening or a tighter close of the loophole than maybe some members of this committee would be comfortable with. And that's why I asked the question.
Who wants to field that? Representative Winkler.
Mr. Chair, Representative Lesch, I guess I can address one narrow part of your question, which is the addition or the further clarification of people who would be included in this list. So 6.7 down through 6.14. We're only talking, your scenario would not apply as a result of this language, because the person that you're describing is not an employee, contractor, or a volunteer at the school, and they are not getting access to this individual because of their employment status or volunteer status or contract status at the school. And so the key line is 6.13, which is the and. It has to be all of these things that cause the perpetrator to have access to the student. So your Dairy Queen scenario, it may be, I'm not sure how that's changed by the rest of the bill.
Okay. I think
Representative Lesch.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. So in reality, my concerns would only apply if this older student was only a school employee and say they were an assistant coach on the girls' volleyball team or something.
Mr. Chair,
Representative Winkler.
That's correct.
Okay. All right, thank you. I may think of some other questions, but for now those concerns are alleviated.
Okay, let's hear from your other sorry, Representative Neuberger.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. I just want to echo just one little more clarification building off what Representative Lesch was talking about. I have a daughter who's in high school, and she's a teacher's aide for one of the teachers. She's clearly in a position of some authority, as some kids would see. She carries out functions that are that helps this teacher. The teacher's aide program is fairly common. So if we have a student who's in a perceived position of authority, such as a teacher's aide, who is 18 or 17. And following Representative Lesch's algorithm here, we have the same type of situation where you have two students shortly thereafter start dating and then have a physical relationship. It goes south. One of them gets mad at the other. Now does this law apply to that student? Is because it would be in a perceived position of authority.
Ms. St. George.
No, it does not. And here's why. If you look at 6.11, and I'm not sure the ages that you're referring to, but I'm going to assume that you're referring to a separation of more than 48 months. If you say because of the actor's employment, volunteer, contractual status, the actor has access to the complainant. In your scenario, whether, and I won't use your daughter as the example, but a person who is in an aide position has access to fellow schoolmates because they're going to that school. Now, a situation in which we know that we have juvenile offenders, clearly. They groom children. They groom other children just the same as adults do. If I, as a prosecutor, see the grooming process because that person has access to that child solely through that aid program, it wouldn't associate in any other way. They're not in the same class. Perhaps they're being an aid, for example, and perhaps those who are in a smaller town understand that we have sometimes K through 12 programs. If the 17-year-old is an aide to 6-year-olds or is an aide to much younger kids, that would be more of the scenario that we would be looking at because of 6.11 all the way through the end.
Representative Neuberger, maybe we could ask staff, if I could ask Mr. Diebel to sort of explain a couple of parts. Maybe this will help if he could explain. It sounds like there are two different provisions that we're talking about here on page 1, the current or recent position of authority, and then on page 2 also, but then on page 6 deals more with schools and other contractual service providers. So if you could just maybe just explain this a little bit, what the current law is, Mr. Diebel, and what the bill and what changes are being made.
Excuse me. Yes, Mr. Chair. So the bill seeks to do two things. The first is to extend the range of the position of authority from the current time period to 2 years beyond the period when the person no longer is in a position of authority. And so Representative Lesch's example of a Dairy Queen manager over a teenager between the age of 16 up to 18 would apply so long as the person in a position of authority was 4 years older than the victim. The second objective of the bill is for in schools where the person isn't technically in a position of authority over the person but gains access to the person, the child, then that person would be subject to third or fourth degree crimsex conduct charges if they have sexual relationship with the child after the relationship ended up to 2 years. So they both extend the scope of the criminal penalties for 2 years beyond the period when their formal relationship ends, but they do seek to do two different things. And one is limited to the school setting, the other applies to any scenario where the adult is in a position of authority over the child.
Okay. Is that helpful?
Yes, Chair.
I'll go back to you, Representative Neuberger, in a second. Representative Lesch.
Thank you. So, if I can, then, Mr. Diebel, what is the most closest example of ages where we could get a felony violation of CSE on this? Then, how close in age could they be,
Mr. Diebel?
Mr. Chair, Representative Lesch, I'll defer to the prosecutor, but imagine that someone up until the day before they turn 18 be the victim, and then someone that was would be then just 4 years older than that or beyond that could be in a position of authority over that person. Once the child becomes 18, then this position of authority no longer applies.
Okay, well, Mr. Chair, Mr. Diebel, that was not the case before. Prior in Minnesota law, it was not. I think I understand this now. So, age of authority applies. In the case of this, what we commonly refer to as statutory rape, it only applied to up to 16. In the case of position of authority, it applied all the way up to 17 years old and 364 days. So, you could have a almost 18-year-old child, and you could have a almost 23-year-old child, almost 24-year-old child, No, well, I can't even do math anymore. If I could have done math, I would have gone to medical school, but here I am at the legislature. Whatever the case, 4 years, and then we would have a felony violation. Is that right?
Mr. Diebel.
Mr. Chair and members, that's my understanding. I stand to be corrected, but...
I believe it's 48 months.
St. George.
Thank you. I believe it's 48 months difference.
Okay.
Okay, let's just go through the chair so we have this on tape. What's going on?
Did Understood. You have question? Thank you, Mr. Chair. Mr. Chair, I'll think about that. I guess I have the same reservations I did before, but I'll let other members of the committee speak.
Representative Neuberger, did you have further comment? Okay, Representative Cornish.
Oh, Mr. Chair, and to the testifier, or Representative Winkler, the one concern I had was right now we have some county attorneys that seemed like they're hesitant to charge. We had a case where it was a coach involved with a student, and the defense put up an argument because this happened, I believe, during the 3 months vacation. There was no position of authority anymore, and it obviously had some effect on the prosecution because they plea bargained it down. And I'm just wondering what the prosecutor think, if Mr. Kingery could come up and give a comment about the willingness for them to prosecute something that's with a vague definition of recent or current or recent. I just wonder if anything came from the prosecutor's request or if they've endorsed this fully or...
Can you make room for Mr. Kingery to testify? Thank you. Mm-hmm. Mr. Kingery, welcome to the committee.
Mr. Chairman, members of the committee, it's been a long week for all of us. Mr. Chairman, members of the committee, my name is John Kingery on behalf of the Minnesota County Attorneys Association. MnCASA did share a draft of this bill with us last year, and we did endorse the draft at that time. However, we did have concerns over the length of time with regard to 2 years. We didn't come up with an alternative, but we thought 2 years was a little long. With regard to the particular case that I believe you're talking about, Representative Cornish, I don't want to pretend to know what went into those decisions, but as you know, the case was eventually, or you may know, the case was eventually dismissed in Blue Earth County.
Representative Cornish. Okay. Thank you for your testimony.
Thank you.
Can we hear maybe from Ms. Dunn now, and then open it back up for questions?
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Representative Winkler, thank you, and committee members. My name is Donna Dunn. I'm the Executive Director of the Minnesota Coalition Against Sexual Assault, and I'm here to speak in support of this proposal. We are a membership organization, representing over 70 sexual assault centers and advocacy programs in Minnesota, and we are working to create a balanced response to sexual violence in Minnesota, which combines both an effective response to victims, survivors in crisis, a responsive justice system, and primary prevention of sexual violence. We see that this bill is one way that for us to respond to and establish cultural understandings and standards that can help protect children and help prevent the lifetime of harm that is done when a young person, and particularly in sexually formative years, finds themselves sexually assaulted, coerced, or manipulated by a person who's been in a position of authority, and this is a person that should be engaged in that child's protection, that child's nurturing and guidance. And we are aware of cases such as Representative Cornish just mentioned, where the actual position of authority has ended, and maybe a week, a month later, the defense might be, this is the position of authority no longer exists, when in fact perhaps the tales of that relationship are still powerful for the child. So I'm here to urge you to support this. We would like to see this enacted. We know that there is confusion right now in the interpretation about when, how the position of authority affects once that actual relationship has ended, when in fact the pressure may still exist. I'd like to offer that I know we've had discussion about the two-year time limit. I believe Ms. St. George can respond to that, but we don't think that is in fact too long a time. Thank you very much.
Thank you for your testimony. Questions? Representative Lesch.
Thank you. Ms. Dunn, would you, so the prosecutions that Ms. St. George is saddled with, there's many of them there's no question about. The 40-year-old creeper who's who's hanging around, who absolutely should know better, is different from the young high school boyfriend, girlfriend, one of whom gets saddled with a lifelong of registering as a sex offender. Is there any room to talk about extending the age or toying with the not just the limit for the 2 years, but also if you are going to expand the statute in this way so as not to ensnare innocent, otherwise innocent young people?
Ms. Dunn.
Mr. Chair, Representative Lesch, I'm glad you used the word toy with. I know that these limits are, in fact, you know, seem to be fairly arbitrary because at some point a person might be a day away from being out of that limit. So I know that there is some arbitrariness or there is some challenge when we set a limit that goes to a particular day in the life of a person. So it seems to me that would have larger impact on the position of authority overall, not only the extension of the coverage of this. So I don't think that I'm the best person to respond to that.
Okay. Well, Mr. Chair.
Representative Lesch.
Absolutely. And I understand that you need a flow chart to follow this now. And we're all sitting around the committee, and if you asked any one individual, there might be very few that could rattle off what's legal and what's not, depending on how old you are and what you do. And that's always very dangerous when we as a legislature set those policies. We need a flow chart to determine what is right and what is wrong in any given state. That said, by being too bright line, you absolutely are going to ensnare more people. So this graduated type of statutory scheme, I think, results in more justice than less. However, to the extent that we're expanding it, I guess I personally, to support it, would like to see some allotment for the other side, where we're not ensnaring those individuals that most of us around the table would agree should not be ensnared.
Representative Johnson.
Mr. Chair, first of all, I want to thank Ms. St. George for coming here today. I've worked with her on numerous cases, and I want to thank her for getting the last crimsex case I had settled without having to leave here to go to court. Question I have is, we've had a few of these situations in Isani County, one involving a youth leader not in a school setting. Would this bill also encompass that situation?
Yes.
Ms. St. George.
Yes, sir, it would.
Thank you.
Representative Ugham.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. I guess I'll be brief, but I think Representative Lesch is right on as far as this goes with the ensnarement and possible problems with younger kids. I think the rest of the bill is very good, but we have to look at this. Those time frames, I think, are much too tight for some of these the younger kids that could be involved with this.
Representative Winkler.
Mr. Chair, I'm certainly open to that conversation. I'm not really sure how this bill changes the complications or makes that more complicated than it is already. It extends it to school employees, volunteers, coaches, people like that, and it extends the time frame for position of authority, but it doesn't change the 48-month period. It doesn't change any of those things. And, you know, there's always the really simple test, which is, you know, if you're going to err on the safe side, you know, when it comes to sexual contact with teenagers.
Mr. Chair.
Representative Lesch.
Absolutely, Representative Winkler. But at a certain point, we're dealing with all kinds of collateral consequences around here now. I mean, this committee has to deal with collateral consequences all the time. I do expungement hearings in Ramsey County, and I have a number of people come up to me. And, you know, just because you're a young kid And you had a CSE, you have a rape charge, and it was one of those technically statutory rapes, as you recall, which is not the words we use for it in Minnesota, but that's what most people understand. So that's the term I use. And I don't presume necessarily that it's completely innocent. I mean, in some of those charges, absolutely the charge should fit. But in some of them, when I have people coming back to me 10 years later or even less than 10 years later who say, you know, I can't get a job, I can't get an apartment, I'm married to her. We were boyfriend and girlfriend at the time, but her dad didn't like me, and the county attorney charged it. Yes, you err on the side of safety, but then inevitably we have to deal with the fallout of that in this committee later on too. So that's why I think maybe those 48-month limits do stand some scrutiny if we're going to expand it to, say, 2 years out from any period of authority, however temporary. That's why I brought it up.
Do you want to say anything else?
Well, Mr. Chair, I don't have any concerns about looking at this issue more broadly. I'm just not sure how this bill raises that issue particularly. And, Representative Lesch, I know you care very much about this, but members, the statistics are fairly startling. We're talking about 1 in 19 girls in this age group being sexually assaulted. I mean, this is a pretty real problem. So, and I'm not suggesting anybody is not concerned about that, but we have to remember that we have these laws in place the way they are for good reason, too.
Okay, so I guess, Representative Winkler, there's still some room to work on this at some point if we pass this on, and I mean, if we, yeah, because we're going to be laying the bill over, so I think that you've heard some concerns about overreach here and what the bill may or may not do, so with that, do you have anything else you want to say?
Mr. Chair, I guess I'd just like to, the final point I would make is that one of the most important parts about this is clarifying the relationship in schools and with coaches, because there is a great deal of uncertainty about that in Minnesota law right now, and we do need to clarify that. I think the discussion about 24 months is the conversation we can have.
Right, exactly. I think your bill does that. So, okay, are there any further discussion? So the chair will lay over House File 1126 for possible inclusion in the Omnibus Public Safety Finance Bill. Thank you, Representative Winkler, and your testifiers. Okay, Representative Simonson, House File 1010. Representative Simonson, welcome to your committee.
Thank you, Mr. Chair, and I would like to move House File 1010 to recommend approval and lay over for possible inclusion in your omnibus finance bill.
Very good. Members, can you please turn your cell phones off, and Representative Simonson, explain your bill.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. This bill, House File 1010, members, is the fix that we need to correct an unintended change in the law. I'll just give you some quick background. In 2005, the legislature enacted a bill to create life sentences for some sex offenders and to recodify the existing sentencing enhancement statutes for sex offenders. One of the primary goals at that time was to increase public safety by imposing harsher sentences on repeat sex offenders. To achieve this, the bill at that time increased the sentencing guideline weights assigned to the most serious prior, first, and second degree offenses. It also assigned offenders an additional custody status point if they committed an offense while on probation or supervised release for a previous criminal sexual conduct offense. It was known at the time that some repeat offenders could fall into the area of the sentencing guideline grid where offenders are recommended probation if they are no longer under supervision and if their prior offense was not one of the more serious offenses which received the added sentencing weights enacted by the 2005 law. However, at that time, a mandatory minimum for repeat offenders was in. It was always intended that repeat offenders would have presumptive prison dispositions, either because of where they fell on the new grid or because of the mandatory minimum provision for subsequent offenders. It came to attention in 2007 that the 36-month presumptive sentencing provision had been repealed, apparently as part of an error when moving the bill through the legislature in 2005. Not only has this resulted in some repeat offenders not being subjected to mandatory sentencing, but it has also weakened prosecutors' ability to achieve reasonable plea agreements. Since 2008, Mincasa has made repeated requests to the legislature to reinstate presumptive sentencing. A fiscal note prepared in 2011 projected that reinstating 36-month presumptive sentencing would have no fiscal impact in the first 2 years after reenactment, and a projected fiscal impact of $19,000 and $58,000 in the third and fourth years after reenactment, growing to $84,000 in the fifth year. This projected fiscal impact has been a barrier to reestablishing 36-month presumptive sentencing. Just to update the committee, an updated fiscal note has been requested. And members, this bill would assure that all repeat criminal sexual conduct offenders, including those whose repeat offenses include third or fourth degree criminal sexual conduct offenses, would be subject to a presumptive minimum 36-month sentence, as was the case prior to 2005. This bill has the support of Mincasa as well as the Minnesota Association of County Attorneys, and I would turn it over to the testifiers.
Thank you, Representative Simonson. Who wants to start? Ms. Dunn?
Thank you, Chair Paymar, Representative Simonson, and committee members. As I said quite recently, my name is Donna Dunn. I'm the Executive Director of the Minnesota Coalition Against Sexual Assault. And I just would briefly like to say that the fact that this oversight happened came to our attention early in 2007 when prosecutors, we work with a group of prosecutors called the Access to Justice Committee, and our role with them is to help understand where what kinds of resources we can help them access in order to make their jobs easier. And one of the things we heard from this group of prosecutors was, what happened to this? I used to have this tool available. It has gone away. And when that was researched further, it was determined that it had gone away inadvertently. It wasn't the intention at the time. So we have had a commitment to bring this issue back. Every time we have brought it to this committee and to other committees, it has been supported entirely. What has been in the way is the fiscal note. I would just like to say, again, we would like to encourage the passage of this to give our criminal justice colleagues another tool to use. Particularly, what's of interest to us is that this is a group of people who are apparently offending in third or fourth degree level criminal sexual conduct. So it's a lower level. And if we have an ability to have to intervene when somebody is repeating offenses at a lower level, may that not, in fact, save us from dealing with somebody who is perpetrating crimes at a much higher level of violence. So we encourage support for this. At the time that this was left out of the sentencing guidelines, it would have made sense that the bed, that the fiscal note, that the money be reclaimed from the Department of Corrections, because that no longer would have applied to them. That, however, did not happen. So it was absorbed in DOC's budget. So again, we're asking for your consideration in supporting this proposal. Thank you.
Thank you for your testimony. Any questions of Ms. Dunn? Okay, then. Ms. Mitchell?
Thank you, Mr. Chair. I'm Kelly Mitchell. I'm Executive Director of the Sentencing Guidelines Commission, and I'm here to let you know that the Commission does support this bill. This bill, the repeal of the 36-month mandatory minimum occurred almost simultaneously with the creation and enactment of the sex offender grid in 2006. When the grid was enacted, the Commission gave very careful consideration to determining which offenders should be recommended for a probationary sentence and which offenders should be recommended for a prison sentence. And that was reflected on the grid. Those in the shaded area are probation, and those that are in the non-shaded area are prison. One area that the Commission didn't, when we built in some additional enhancements, as Representative Simonson explained just a few moments ago, but one area that we didn't specifically enhance on the grid was the shaded area for repeat sex offenders, because when the grid was developed, we thought this 36-month mandatory minimum was already in place, and it wasn't necessary to build any more enhancements into the grid to take care of repeat offenders. but the commission does believe that it serves public safety to sentence repeat offenders more harshly than first-time offenders. And so for those reasons, we do support this bill. Thank you.
Any questions? Okay, then. Representative Simonson, do you have anything further to say? Or let me ask if there's anyone who is has opposition to this bill. Oh, okay. Very well. Please state your name for the
Chairman
record.
And committee members, I'm Ryan Els, and I represent the Minnesota Association of Criminal Defense Lawyers. I would just like to point out that this bill limits judicial discretion in a way that has been counter to many of the legal trends that have been favored by both the United States Supreme Court and the Minnesota Supreme Court that recognize the necessity of judges to be able to sentence according to the specific parameters of the case that they're dealing with. And by taking those powers away from the judge, it just limits the judge's ability to reach the appropriate sentence. It's also just not necessary for public safety reasons that have been, as was cited earlier, there have already been increased mandatory sentences for the worst of the sex offenders. And so the people who would be targeted by this provision would be the less serious offenders, and those are the cases in which I think the judges really do need to be able to exercise additional discretion.
I'm sorry, what was your name again?
Ryan Else, E-L-S-E.
E-L-S-E. Representative Lesh.
Thank you. Mr. Chair, and I'm wondering, in light of Mr. L's testimony, I don't recall hearing when we have people come in and testify about modifying, as Mr. L's has stated, restricting the authority of individual judges. I don't recall hearing examples of instances where judges have maybe abused the discretion afforded them under the sentencing guidelines. And is that driving this bill? Do we have examples, maybe the author has, of judges who have abused their discretion. And so we have to restrict their discretion, all the judges in the state, because a few of them failed to appropriately sentence these repeat offenders. And what were those instances? Do we have those? Maybe Ms. Mitchell has examples of that. What are the? I think we should know the judges' names.
Are you? Do you have a question here?
I'd like to know the names of the Mr. Chair. I'd like to know the names of the judges who. I don't want to use the word abuse of discretion because that may not be the appropriate characterization, but who failed to sentence how we would expect. Which judges were those, and why do we have to change the law because they didn't do that?
Ms. Mitchell, do you want to respond to that?
Thank you, Mr. Chair and Representative Lesh. What I can say, I don't think I can answer your question directly, but this is what I can say. Prior to the repeal of the law, there was about a 15% departure rate for offenders who would have been subject to the mandatory minimum. And those departures are appropriate because the role of the departure is to take into account circumstances that are atypical. The mandatory minimum and the guidelines are appropriate for the typical case. Departures are appropriate when there's an atypical case. So in that case, I think the judge actually appropriately exercised discretion and determined that prison would not have been the right sentence for that 15% of offenders.
Representative Lesh.
Okay, thank you. So, Ms. Mitchell, then, you don't have a departure rate now because it wouldn't be a departure. So do you have commensurate metrics suggesting if it's happened differently since we didn't have after the guidelines are in place?
Ms. Mitchell.
Mr. Chair and Representative Paymar, yes, there have been just eight offenders since 2006 who fall into this category where their offense occurred more than 15 years ago, or I'm sorry, less than 15 years ago, and they've now committed a new offense, but their criminal history is low enough that they don't fall into the shaded portion of the grid. In one of those eight cases, the prosecutor sought an aggravated sentence, and the judge did actually aggravate the sentence and send the offender to prison. So the other seven received probationary sentences instead because that's what was appropriate under the guidelines.
Okay, thank you.
Representative List.
Mr. Chair, so we've gone from 15% to 1 in 8, and again, I can't do math, so I don't know what that is. But I presume that's somewhat of a drop. Do we have, of the other seven, do we know who those judges are? And has anyone asked them what was their reasons for doing this?
Ms. Mitchell, I don't. Are you asking her to name the judges?
Mr. Chair, yes.
Representative,
if she has them.
Ms. Mitchell?
Mr. Chair and Representative Lesh, I don't have those names today, but there's really no issue with the judges having acted inappropriate. They were following the guidelines. What we're trying to say here is that the guidelines, without the mandatory minimum in place, are contrary to the intent of the commission. The commission did believe that a prison sentence was appropriate for these offenders because they're repeat offenders. But with the mandatory minimum repealed, the judge doesn't have a choice other than to sentence the offender to probation because that's where they fall on the grid. And then the prosecutor would be the one to have to pursue an aggravated sentence, which, as we all know, after Blakely is a much more rigorous process.
Okay. All right. Thank you. Other questions?
Do you have a response to Mr. Elsie's comments, or do you want to just, or Representative Simonson, or you want to?
I can just answer it in my closing comment.
Okay. Thank you, Mr. Elsie, for your testimony. Anyone else who wishes to speak in opposition to the bill? Very good. Are there any further discussion or questions? Representative Simonson, you get the last word.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. And very briefly, in your packet, members, there should be a letter from the Minnesota Sentencing Guidelines Commission. And on the second page or the last page of that letter talks about these nine instances that you just heard described here in response to Representative Lesh's question. So if you have further questions, it's spelled out pretty well in that letter. But okay. Beyond that, I think it's a good bill, and I would encourage your support.
Okay, so Representative Simonson renews his motion that House File 1010 be laid over for possible inclusion in the Omnibus Public Safety Finance Bill. All those, Chair will lay that over. So, Representative Simonson, why don't you just stay up there and do your other bill as long as you're there.
Before he does it, Mr. Chair, can I say something?
Yes, Representative Lash.
And just to clarify, I wanted to wait until that bill was done, but I think it's absolutely appropriate. During times where we're talking about modifying guidelines, I am an advocate for judicial discretion on this committee. And if we're going to restrict judicial discretion, I think it's absolutely appropriate to have conversations about why we're doing it, in which instances. I think that Representative Simon and the testifiers adequately explained to me in this committee the reasons for it, and Ms. Mitchell did. But I think we dance around that question far too often. And I think it's important to get specific. So that's all I wanted to say, Mr. Chair.
Very good. Thank you. Representative Simonson, you want to present House File, or do you want to move House File 449?
Thank you, Mr. Chair. And I will move House File 449 with the recommendation to pass and be re-referred to the Committee on Taxes. And I think my subsequent comments will explain why.
Okay, we'll leave that motion there for now. Why don't you explain your bill?
And I'm going to apologize ahead of time, Mr. Chair, because we seem to have some confusion on amendments. I think in your packet there should be a 13-0207.
Okay, so Representative Simonson moves the 207 amendment to get the bill in the shape that he wants it. Any discussion? All those in favor signify by saying aye.
Aye.
Aye. Opposed? Okay, Representative Simonson.
In addition to that, and this is where my confusion comes in, is I also have an amendment that's not in your packet, but I will explain the amendment, and then what I will do is try to include it as we move on to the next committee stop, if that's all right with you, because we're inside the 24 hours.
Is it a substantive amendment?
It's a very substantive amendment. And it will explain why I need this to go.
All right, Representative Simonson, go ahead, and then we'll see where we're at.
Okay. The bill, members, is essentially, the amendment that I wanted to have in front of you is essentially a delete-all amendment that changes the revenue source for this reimbursement of sales tax paid to, rather than come from the 911 fund, to come from the general fund. So you can imagine that's a significant change. And I really, at that point, would even question why it's here in front of you, other than we are going to talk a little bit about armor purchases, which is somewhat relevant.
Very good.
So as I move forward, it'll be my intent to introduce that amendment, and that will alleviate a number of concerns from a number of folks that I've heard from. But to the bill itself, the bill will accomplish what I would call fairness in the state with respect to sales tax paid by counties and cities on end-user equipment related to armor. And we've heard a number of times this session discussions about armor, and we know what that means with the Allied radio metric system that that is now in place across the state. The original bill was drafted to talk about taking these dollars out of the 911 account, and since that has been done, I've had a number of discussions with a number of interested parties. And while there may be dollars in that account right now today, I'm convinced that those dollars need to stay there as we move forward to subsequent projects enhancing our 911 system and our radio system. So I don't think that's a good funding source. And quite frankly, if I'm going to try to sell you this bill on the concept of fairness, I think that it does need to be made up within the general fund. With respect to the fiscal note, which should be in your packet, and again, as I move forward to get us in front of the tax committee, I don't find that this fiscal note is really accurate, because as the note explains, it assumes that tax dollars that were paid with grants received by counties would be reimbursed, and that is not my intent of this particular bill. So a number of tax dollars were paid with grants across the state, and that's going to reduce the size of that fiscal note. But again, once we get this bill in the shape that we wanted, I think that the fiscal note will be significantly less. But we will work on that before we get to the tax committee. So you're asking me, why are we here in front of you? Minnesota statute currently exempts 25 counties across the state from paying sales tax on these end-user equipments due to implementation of armor. And the 25 include 9 metro counties, as well as the southeast corner of the state of Minnesota, which leaves 62 counties that are paying and have paid sales tax, and in comparison to the 25 that have not, I find that to be unfair. This bill, as drafted, would be retro to purchases made after January 1st, 2011. And at this point, I would just like to turn it over to testifier John Ungaro on behalf of St. Louis County.
Welcome to the committee.
Thank you, Mr. Chair and members. For the record, John Ungaro, Government Relations Director for St. Louis County. Representative Simonson asked me to just say a few words here today about the property tax implications that armor has had on counties, as well as the on-again and off-again situation when it comes to the sales tax exemption on equipment for armor. Overall, in the state, since the implementation of armor, close to $100 million in local levy has been raised by counties to pay for our portion of the armor system. And to put that into perspective for my county, that translates into about $8 million, which coincidentally is about an 8% increase in our levy. Now, obviously, we didn't pay for that all in one year, but it gives you an idea of how significant this dollar amount can be for local county budgets. As far as the sales tax exemption issue, I can honestly say that it was a nice carrot that the state had to offer and that first wave of counties, of 25 counties, I think, you know, that helped convince them to go to Armour. And quite honestly, for most of that next wave of counties, likewise, they thought that they were going to be able to achieve that same sales tax exemption. And I can really say that it was a deciding factor for several counties to go forward with Armour rather than the least expensive but lower quality VHF narrowband option. So I guess I have to echo what Representative Simonson said about the fairness and equity that needs to be implemented so that those remaining counties have the same treatment that the initial wave of counties received when it comes to the sales tax exemption. And I agree with him that I think the overall fiscal note can be reduced because we're probably double counting some of the grants that counties received as part of building their Armour systems. And obviously we don't endorse getting a sales tax exemption on and grant money. So we're optimistic that overall fiscal note will keep going down somewhat.
Thank you, Mr. Engel. Any questions of the testifier? Representative Cornish. Engoro, I should
say. Mr. Chair.
Is it Engoro? I'm sorry, Engoro?
Angaro.
Angaro.
It's actually a view. I just was wondering about the oral amendment. It's kind of substantive amendment, and I would rather have it done somewhere else in this committee with this shorter notice. I mean, switching the funding if that was planned. But I support the bill because one of my counties is involved, but just...
I think that we were. I was asking Representative Simonson if he would, if this is okay. I mean, I get that we would, that the motion would be to pass it without recommendation to the Committee on Taxes, and that's when the substantive amendment would be offered. And if we can find millions of dollars in the general fund to do this, do that.
Okay.
Is that okay? I mean, if it's not, we can just lay it on the table. Lay it on the table, I guess, and take it up.
Mr. Chair, maybe before we move forward, the cleanest way to do this would be to withdraw my original motion and make a motion to have this committee, without recommendation, refer to taxes.
Well, I'm fine with a recommendation, but or to pass it. You know.
As a member of the tax committee, I think it was probably a good. I think it's probably a good substitute motion.
Okay.
So any questions? Any other questions? Representative Simonson, anything else? You want to renew your motion then?
I will renew my motion that House File 449 be re-referred to taxes without recommendation.
Be passed as amended,
as amended
without recommendation and referred to the Committee on Taxes. Any discussion on that motion? All those in favor signify by saying aye. Aye.
Aye.
Opposed? Motion prevails. Thank you, Representative Simon.
Thank you.
Okay. How about some info? Ooh, this seat is warm. I
wonder why you wanted to go without recommendation.
Hello. Chair, I'd like to move
Representative Faymar.
House File 1400 to pass and be referred to the General Register, and I have a small oral amendment.
Go, Ked. What is the oral amendment?
The oral amendment is on line 7.18. Strike the word abuse. And insert the word conduct.
The amendment is on line 7.18. The first word of the line, abuse, strike the word abuse and insert conduct. All in favor of the motion signify by saying aye.
Aye.
Aye. All opposed say no. Motion passes. Thank you, Representative Paymar, to your bill as amended.
Mr. Chair, members, this bill does four slight things to our statute on violating protection orders. On page 2 of the bill, it strikes the word knowingly if you violate an order for protection, you violate the order, and we're deleting the word knowingly from statute. Given the and the second thing it does, given the technological changes over the years, on page 4 of the bill, we have some language about venue, which would include violations of an order for protection, not just coming from a landline telephone, but also would include cell phones for violations of a DANCO or an order for protection. On page 5 of the bill, it has a language that includes removes the language family or household members, allowing the enhancement of a violation of a no-contact order. And it also clarifies the violations of protective orders qualify as conduct to be used when prosecuting domestic assault cases. With me is Mr. Pinto from the County Attorney's Office and Ms. Richards from the Minnesota Coalition for Battered Women. So if I could turn it over to Mr. Pinto.
Thank you, Mr. Pinto. Please introduce yourself for the record and proceed with your testimony.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Members, Dave Pinto, P-I-N-T-O, Assistant Ramsey County Attorney. I'm here on behalf of the Minnesota County Attorneys Association, which has endorsed House File 1400. I want to thank the chair and members, and, of course, especially Representative Paymar, our sponsor of the bill, for their leadership on domestic violence issues. House File 1400 is a set of four, as Representative Paymar described them, updates or fixes, some cleanup to domestic violence statutes. Members should have a sheet prepared by Minnesota Coalition for Battered Women that has some information about the changes. I'll quickly walk through the four of them. First change is in Bill Sections 1, 4, and 5 relating to violations of protective orders. First, the structure of domestic violence statutes, including for protective orders, is such that a defendant who violates a protective order or has a domestic assault will receive a misdemeanor unless the defendant has a certain prior record. One prior qualified domestic type offense in the prior 10 years gives the defendant a gross misdemeanor, and two priors in the past 10 years gives the defendant a felony. That's the basic structure. Well, in the protective order statutes, the violations of protective order requires that the state prove that the defendant knew of the existence of the order. That's the basic requirement. Well, in the statute currently, there's an additional word, this word of knowingly violated the order, only for gross misdemeanor and felony violations of those orders. One might think that that word knowingly violated is the same as knowing the existence of the order, but in a couple of appellate decisions last year that actually overturned convictions, the appellate court said no, that word knowingly means that the state has to prove both the defendant knew of the order and knowingly violated the order, sort of adding this additional level. This is, of course, a higher mental standard then for those gross misdemeanor and felony level crimes as opposed to the misdemeanor level. And there's no policy justification for the distinction. Our thought is that it was simply an error that word was put in there. And the statute, the change would strike the word knowingly, and therefore reconciling the three levels, misdemeanor, gross misdemeanor, and felony. So that's the first of the four changes. Second change is in sections 2 and 6. As Representative Paymar said, this has to do with just updating regarding modern means of communication. There were past updates in past sessions to the laws regarding stalking and violation of harassment restraining orders, providing for venue with respect to calls and texts and electronic communications. And the bill simply has the same update with regard to orders for protection and violations of domestic abuse no contact orders. I'd point the committee's attention to bill lines 6.1 to 6.5, which happen to contain the current law regarding harassment restraining orders. That law, again, was put into place, I think, just last year. And so the committee will note that lines 6.1 through 6.5, having to do with harassment restraining orders, are the same languages in bill sections 2 and 6 with regard to these additional protective orders. So again, simply making a fix and a cleanup regarding those. Third change is in bill section 3. Again, there's the structure, as I said, misdemeanor, gross misdemeanor, felony level, depending on the number of prior, what's called the qualified domestic violence-related offenses, or QVROs. Well, with regard to almost all domestic offenses, it doesn't matter who the victim of that QDVRO was. As long as it was an assault or it was some kind of protective order that the defendant violated, it qualifies and can be used to enhance a later offense. The only exception is gross misdemeanor domestic assault. For some reason, there was language put in there with that statute that requires that the QDVRO have been against a domestic victim, a family or household member. Again, there's no policy justification for that, and it's different in that statute as against all the other ones, different than felony domestic assault, for example. So again, the bill would strike that phrase and reconcile gross misdemeanor domestic assault with all the other domestic offenses. The fourth change is in Section 7, and this has to do with the statute that allows other domestic conduct to be introduced, evidence of other domestic conduct to be introduced in domestic prosecutions. For a long time, it was thought by the courts would admit evidence of this domestic conduct in any kind of domestic case, including violations of protective orders. But last year, in the State v. Sparkman case, the court pointed out that under the statute, that kind of evidence could only get in when domestic abuse had occurred in the current case. The current case had to do with domestic abuse, and the violation of a protective order would not be domestic abuse. And so this change simply makes it clear the statute can be used with respect to violations of protective orders. Violation doesn't have to be physically violent, and provides that the evidence that can be introduced or the kind of evidence that can be introduced will match the kind of case when that evidence can be introduced. In either case, it's domestic conduct. I know that that's a lot, but I think it boils down to four fairly technical as opposed to substantive changes.
Thank you, Mr. Pinto. Before we go to Ms. Richards, Representative Simon has a question. Representative Simon.
I do. Thanks, Mr. This is for Mr. Pinto, I think, or for the bill author. Changes 2, 3, and 4 I have no problem with, and probably will have no problem with number 1, and I'm a reliable hardliner on this stuff, except for if we get rid of the word knowingly. I'm always a little bit nervous when we don't have a state of mind stated and we just have kind of a what appears to be a strict liability kind of standard. If we get rid of that, is there some other substantive provision elsewhere that would, not in this bill, that would impose some sort of state of mind requirement on a violation, or is it just literally for any reason? I mean, if for example, part of an order for protection is that someone not be within a certain number of feet of someone else, and they just purely through accident and inadvertence find themselves at a sporting event or at the state fair or something like that, I just want to make sure that there's some state of mind requirement, not just literally any violation.
Mr. Pinto.
Thank you, Mr. Chair and Representative Simon. There are actually two mental states that still will be in place even striking knowingly. Okay. In the sense that first, the state will have to prove, as with any violation of protective order, that the defendant knew of the existence of the order, so that's an element regardless. And then this crime, so any crime when an intent intent is not specified in the text, it's a general intent crime. And so the state is still required to prove general intent. It's not a strict liability crime, and the courts are pretty limited in what can be a strict liability crime.
That was my only question. Thanks.
Mr. Pinto, my question related to that, too. Did the Court of Appeals or Supreme Court, whichever court cases you're dealing with, construe the current statutory scheme as a specific intent crime because of knowingly in there? I'm not following their interpretation of the law. What made it problematic?
Mr. Chair, thank you. The case that I was citing was State v. Gunderson, 812 Northwest 2nd, 156. And the court said, to quote, "The question then is whether the gross misdemeanor slash felony term knowingly violates requires more than proof that an individual knew of the existence of the order and in fact violated that order." Of course, a misdemeanor violation would simply require the person knew of the order and in fact violated it. And the court answered that question, yes. Because of the term knowingly, the state was required to prove more than simply the individual knew of the order and violated the order. And it's that the bill change is attempting to deal with. So it's simply the knowing of the order and violating it just as in a misdemeanor violation.
I think I understand. So any prosecutor is prosecuting this case and district court simply had to prove knowledge of the existence of the order, and it was their intent to prove a general intent to violate it, and the court said, well, you needed to prove something else there that you didn't put into evidence, therefore, boom, overturned. Is that right?
It is, Mr. Chair, yes, that's true. And in fact, the challenge in the Gunderson case and another subsequent case was that the jury instruction, this is so seemingly so straightforward, that the jury instructions actually did not include that word knowingly because the committee of attorneys who drafted them thought simply the same elements applied, know of the existence of the order and violated it. And the court flipped those convictions in part because that instruction hadn't been there, but in the course of saying that had pointed out that there would be this additional element required, essentially getting into the subjective intent. So making this into a specific intent crime, though they didn't use that term.
Okay, thank you. Ms. Richards.
Chair and committee, I'm not actually here to testify. I was here to sit if there are any questions. We are coming here in support of the bill with the Minnesota County Attorneys Association.
Thank you very much, Ms. Richards. Questions for members of the committee? Representative Johnson.
Mr. Chair, I have the same concern that you did with the word knowingly being taken out along with Representative Simon. My question is how would it work with, I don't know if everybody else knows about short orders. I've served many of them. When we do a short order, we do not list all the elements of the order. We just notify the person of the order and give them a copy of the basic order. And if a violation occurs before they actually get their order, they wouldn't knowingly know what's in that order. By taking this out, they could be charged on that order even though they don't know what's in it at that time, correct?
Mr. Pinto.
Mr. Chair, Representative Johnson, again, proving a violation would be the same whether it's a misdemeanor, gross misdemeanor, or felony. So the state would be required to prove that the defendant knew of the order and had, in fact, violated the order. In the case that you describe, if the defendant were charged with a misdemeanor, this obviously doesn't change that at all. We have to prove those things. And the fact the defendant happens to have a prior conviction within the past 10 years or two priors, so we're in gross misdemeanor or felony land, shouldn't change the requirement to prove that. So, yes, the state would have to show the defendant knew of the order, and if, say, the short form used to serve the defendant didn't include the extra information, then I think that element would be very difficult for the state to prove at that point. And, again, that has nothing to do with this additional word knowingly.
If I can help by explanation, Representative Johnson, there are two elements. There's the knowledge of the order, which is the knowingly, but then the court construed that there's a second part that required knowingly, and that be that you knowingly violated it. And removal of that word knowingly would in no way remove the knowing element, knowing word from the first element. They still do have to show it, and that was the concern Representative Simon raised and has been adequately addressed for my purposes anyway. Representative Cornish.
Mr. Chair, Representative Paymar and I both carried bills like this before and big advocates for this organization, but it still bothers me if all prosecutors will interpret and enforce this the same and cops, and it's a huge stretch just on the face when you strike knowingly out of, because we got so many laws that say with intent or knowingly or it's just, I guess I got the same concern, and if it doesn't make any difference, why are we taking it out if there's still unknowingly there? Just bothers me somewhat.
I understand. Mr. Pinto.
Mr. Chair and Representative Cornish, again, the misdemeanor version of this has this requirement of knowing the violation, of knowing that the order exists. If you imagine inserting that word knowingly into the misdemeanor version, it would be that the person who knows of the existence and then knowingly violates, and that obviously it's sort of this double, and that's essentially what's going on with the gross misdemeanor and felony versions of the statute, as it's adding an additional element again, for the consistency at each stage, there's still the requirement that the state prove a certain mental state. But this requires this additional level, as I say, has been a challenge in these appellate cases.
Mr. Pinto. Representative Cornish, go ahead.
Just as a follow-up, I think it would be a good idea in the future if we have bills like this, me included, to run it by prosecutors when you have something like this, and have them come to the table, have them have time to study it and reassure us and take a formal position on it would make me feel more comfortable. Yeah. But I'll probably still vote for the bill anyway, but it would be.
Representative Paymar.
Mr. Chair, could Mr. Pinto explain what the process that this bill's gone through?
Mr. Chair, Representative Cornish. So the bill has been endorsed by the Minnesota County Attorneys Association. So I'm here. I'm here testifying on behalf. It went through both the Criminal Law Committee, and then also through the board of the County Attorneys Association.
You said that earlier in your testimony. I missed it. Sorry.
Am I correct? Would I be correct in stating, Mr. Pinto, that the second knowingly, which people are focused on, is kind of extraneous. Like a sixth toe or something, what would a prosecutor look at that and say, wouldn't they just dismiss that and say knowingly what? I mean, if it's not a specific intent crime, there would be no point to even considering that word knowingly in the second part. Am I correct?
Mr. Chair, I guess I'll point out that the members of the jury instruction committee, who are quite experienced attorneys, when they put together the criminal jury instructions for this crime, as well as the attorneys working on the several cases that got flipped on appeal, they saw that word knowingly and just thought that it was the same as knowing of the existence of the order. The court, carefully parsing the language of the statute, said, well, no, the word has this additional meaning and added on this additional gloss on top of it. But to point out, there were a number of experienced attorneys who did, in fact, yes, I think that's right, Mr. Chair, who did believe it was superfluous. We now have the courts looking at it and saying, well, no, actually, it adds this additional requirement. But again, it's a requirement that we believe was probably not intended when these statutes were enacted, to have an additional level of looking into the subjective intent of the defendant in ways that we don't in other crimes.
Mr. Pinto, did the court suggest of what kind of specific intent knowingly would construe, or did they just leave that blank?
Mr. Chair, what they said in the implication, again, that the state would be required to prove the defendant's subjective understanding of the language of the order and what was in the defendant's mind. I'm not sure if there was more than that in the Gunderson case.
Thank you. Representative Simon.
So, Mr. Pinto, and in terms of Representative Cornish's question, I know that you are a prosecutor and you do this stuff for a living. So back to my original hypothetical, I just want to make sure I'm understanding. Let's say there's an order in place that a perpetrator is not to be within, 500 feet of victim. They run into each other at the state fair, Sweet Martha's Cookies or something like that. They each went on their a trip there completely separately, and the perpetrator knows of the order, knows that he's under an obligation not to appear within 500 feet of the victim, totally understands that, knows it every day. But suddenly there he is at the state fair, victim sees him, calls someone. What result?
Mr. Pinto.
Mr. Chair, Representative Simon, I think I'll compare your hypothetical to a situation where, if the defendant is unconscious and is brought to be next to a victim, well, clearly there's not the general intent at that point. There needs to be the sufficient consciousness and awareness of what's going on to be prosecuted. So there, too, if the defendant turns around and the victim is there at that moment, the defendant doesn't have the general intent to do something. Now, if the defendant does not turn around and leave at that point, well, then there's the consciousness of what's going on, and then, in fact, the person can be prosecuted. And that's why this, like others, is a general intent crime. There is a necessity, it's not strict liability, there is a necessity of awareness and consciousness, but it's not that next level up of needing to get into the defendant's mind about precisely how that person was interpreting the order and proving that they were thinking of it and were aware of their own violation in a particular way.
Mr. Gibson Simon. Questions from members?
What are we doing? Passing the general register.
Okay, there being no other questions, then Representative Paymar renews his motion that House File 1400, as amended, be recommended to pass and referred to the general register. All in favor signify by saying aye.
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 All opposed say no. Motion passes. Thank you, members. No, nothing else. Are we adjourning or recessing? Okay. There being no other business before the committee, committee is adjourned.